Making a decent living as a serious novelist is not easy. It's never been easy. Rave reviews and showing up on lists of best young writers don't mean that a publisher will earn any money selling your books or that you'll be able to make more than the minimum wage writing them. And that was pretty much how things were going for the British writer Glen Duncan in his 40s after his 7th well-reviewed novel. Instead of giving up on fiction, though, Duncan made a New Year's resolution to write a book about the last werewolf on Earth, which he did and published last year, and now he's written the sequel, Tallulah Rising, about a single woman who's pregnant, and when the moon is full, she turns into a bloodthirsty monster. Glen Duncan, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you very much for having me.
So is that actually how it went down, New Year's Eve? Were you drunk? What year, when was it?
It was New Year's Eve, yes, and I was indeed drunk, as was everybody else. And we had done what we do every New Year's Eve, which is to, you know, force down some freezing champagne on the roof terrace and watch the firework display and then come back downstairs and take stock of what we've done in the last 12 months and, rather more worryingly, what we might hope to do in the next 12. And having spent yet another year very, very far from the literary spotlight, when somebody asked me what I was going to do this coming year, in a fit of sort of drunken pique, I said, I'm going to write a novel about the last werewolf on Earth, titled, and this is where creative genius really sidestepped the obvious, The Last Werewolf. And unlike practically any other idea I've ever had for a novel, all my friends sort of feebly agreed that it wasn't a bad idea. So the next morning I woke up and revisited it, and there you go. The Last Werewolf was born.
In Tallulah Rising and the previous one, you embrace all of the standard received werewolf conventions, the full moon, the silver bullets, the talking to wolves. Did you ever think, I should invent new backstory, or were you happy just to take the givens?
I kept the parts of the mythology that I thought were cool, and ditched the ones that I didn't. So, you know, in some versions, for example, of the werewolf myth, the transformation can be affected at will. That does not leave you with the same moral problem.
Right.
The moral problem's only interesting if it's something that you cannot control. So the full moon transformation exclusively was always going to be part of my version of the werewolf myth.
As it is in modern movies, like An American Werewolf in London from the 1980s, how much did that film play into your thinking as you were writing these books?
That definitely made an impression on me, chiefly because it took the moral quandary seriously and was very funny and had a believable love story.
David, you're hurting my feelings.
Hurting your feelings? Has it occurred to you that it might be unsettling to see you rise from the grave to visit me?
Now, I'm really sorry to be upsetting you, but I have to warn you.
Warn me?
We were attacked by a werewolf.
I'm not listening to this.
On the moors, we were attacked by a lycanthrope, a werewolf. I was murdered, an unnatural death. And now I walk the earth in limbo until the werewolf's curse is lifted.
Shut up.
The wolf's bloodline must be severed. The last remaining werewolf must be destroyed. It's you, David.
So that's American Werewolf in London, which, when it came out 30 years ago, and it was intended to be this kind of cool, new-style werewolf movie. That had an effect on you at the time?
Yeah, very much. I mean, for that mix of ingredients, almost everything that I'd seen before that was played very, very straight. And the idea seemed to be that if you wanted to frighten people, that's all you could do. Or if you wanted to explore another dimension, some supernatural dimension, it was all done with this incredible po-faced literalism. An American Werewolf in London, I thought, really stirred up the mix. It's a very funny film. I still find it a very funny film. Fall in love with Jenny Agutter all over again every single time I see it. And, you know, the two, I suppose, stock genre episodes in that film, the attack at the beginning and the transformation scene, were both you know, absolutely terrifically handled and creepy and frightening. And I just thought that was a terrific achievement to get all that in and some laughs and a kind of emotional depth. And as I said, to take the moral quandary seriously.
And so when you came to do your own, did you feel that prose fiction, on the other hand, hadn't really advanced and modernized in this realm since, I don't know, Mary Shelley?
You know, I'm not qualified to answer it for the simple reason that outside of the classics, I've not really read any horror fiction. So I don't really know what's going on, or at least what was going on in the commercial end of the market. Uh-huh. But what was apparent to me was that if a novel was going to succeed with something like a werewolf, it had to deliver what great novels can, which is interiority. We're living in a world now where, thanks to CGI technology, there is nothing that cannot be convincingly rendered in the visual field. I mean, we can, you know, we've seen transformation scenes now a million times. We've seen people flying through the air and so on, and it all looks seamlessly convincing. Mm-hmm. But what the movies can't do, of course, is to tell you what that feels like inside while you're going through it.
Well, let's give our listeners a taste of that. Could you read a little bit from Tallulah Rising?
I stood, transformed, jaws open, tongue as thick as a baby's arm, breath going up in signals of dreadful life, half a dozen trees back from the edge of the drive. Moments ago, I hadn't wanted this. Now I wanted nothing else. Same every time. You forgot the curse was an exchange, took your speech and your mercy, but gave you in return the planet's dumb throb and your own share in it. Lilac shadows on the snow, the fine-tuned trees, the Eucharist moon and the victim's heart, like a song calling you home. Caitlin wouldn't see me waiting here. She wouldn't see me until the last moment. But in all the moments before the last moment, she'd know what she didn't want to know, that the worst thing had come to her. The worst thing was a simple thing, an old thing, an ordinary thing. And here it was. She'd look for God, guardian angels, miraculous intervention, and get nothing. Just the trees and the snow and the moon. Nothing from them either. She'd get the real universe once before the end.
That was Glenn Duncan reading from his new novel, Tallulah Rising. To what extent, if any, is the werewolf a metaphor for you of the true cold-blooded savagery that human beings are capable of?
Well, the central way, I suppose, in which these things function is just that they are a way of looking at the gap between the way we are and the way we want to be. So, I mean, every novel, in a way, that I've published up until these has been about that. It's been about being at the mercy of desires and drives, and, you know, the sort of seductive voice of compromise. The starting point, I suppose, for me was, or at least the moral starting point was, if you said to somebody, right, you're a werewolf, you have to transform into a beast once a month, kill and eat another person, or you will die. The moral reflex, the knee-jerk there, the fairy story, to say, oh, well, I'd kill myself. You know, it's untenable. And yet, you know, I don't think you would.
Yep.
My suspicion is that a large number of people would negotiate it, would accommodate atrocity, and I suppose that's the heart of the metaphor. You know, one of the most alarming things about being human is the speed and ease with which we assimilate atrocity.
And on that cheerful note, I want to thank you very much, Glenn Duncan.
Thank you.
Glenn Duncan's new novel is called Tallulah Rising, and so if you hadn't made that drunken New Year's resolution to write a werewolf book, what would you be doing now?
I'm not sure what I would be doing. Living off my girlfriend, probably, because having been doing this now for the better part of 20 years, I have rendered myself effectively unemployable. I mean, can you see the interview? So, Mr. Duncan, you've been a full-time novelist for the last 20 years. Why do you want to come and work for Topshop? You know?
Yeah.
It's not going to fly, right?
Because I understand people. I'm empathetic to their inner drives and needs.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure that would convince anyone.